From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Day 3 of ballot counting for the next president of the United States, and we're expected new updates from key states. Former Vice President Joe Biden has won 264 electoral votes and President Trump 214, according to projections from the Associated Press. Again, 270 votes are needed to win the presidency.
But the Trump campaign is also still on a path to victory. They have won, and they've launched a number of legal challenges as well in an attempt to stop vote counting in some key states. Today, a Georgia judge dismissed a lawsuit from the Trump campaign about absentee ballots. Let's bring in Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Domenico, this is democracy at work, and it can be nerve-wracking. But tell us, what are you watching now?
Well, we have some of those outstanding states, obviously, where the margins are very, very, very close. You know, Nevada, we're expecting to hear at some time, maybe in the next hour or so, about outstanding vote in Clark County, where Las Vegas is, and in Washoe County, where Reno is, because the margin there right now is only 7,600 votes out of about a million votes cast. So very close, with Joe Biden in the lead. Of course, if Joe Biden were to be officially declared the winner in Nevada and the Arizona result holds up, then he would have enough electoral votes to be declared the president-elect at 270. But, you know, Arizona is still somewhat of a question mark. You know, even though the Associated Press has called it, there are still a lot of outstanding vote there. It's only about a 68,000 margin out of almost 2 million votes there. So we're continuing to watch that, as is the Associated Press. So I wouldn't think that this is necessarily completely done with at this point. Georgia, also another place where the Biden campaign is hopeful, going the other direction. The margin there is less than 15,000 votes now out of 5 million and continuing to close with, about 60,000 votes or so remaining.
Well, you said Arizona, if the count holds up. And I just want to ask you about that, because, as you mentioned, this is the Associated Press count that puts Joe Biden at 264 electoral votes. And NPR, we adhere to the AP count. But the AP, NPR, Fox News all called that state, as you just explained, the AP did, for Joe Biden. Today, the AP's executive editor said that the Associated Press continues to watch and analyze vote count results from Arizona as they come in. We will follow the facts in all the cases. Mm-hmm. And this is why, you know, some of us have Joe Biden at 264 electoral votes, some it's 253. So do you think there's a chance then that that Arizona call, I mean, this is speculation on your part, but that that Arizona call might change?
Well, I just think people need to have a degree of patience here. You know, there's still a degree of votes that are out, and the other broadcast networks that are also very good at making calls and reading this, they want to see where the vote is and where the vote's being cast, how much that percentage of the vote that's remaining there winds up going to Biden or to Trump. Because, you know, a place like Maricopa County, for example, while Biden is leading there right now, it has a history of going, of being traditionally Republican. So, you know, I just think people need to pause, even though calls are made. It's not like the Associated Press has put its hat on the wall and said they're not going to continue counting, because they certainly are going to continue counting all the way to the end and take a look at what's happening there. I just think it's one of those states that it's because it's so close, we just have to continue to monitor. Yeah. As is Pennsylvania, where the margin right now is 117,000 votes in favor of President Trump. However, votes continue to come in, especially in the Philadelphia area, central Philadelphia in particular, where the Biden campaign is pretty confident that at the end of the day, that will put Biden over the top. Now, the Trump campaign wants to have better access to monitoring the vote count there, which is what may be contributing to some vote delays or vote halting. But at the end of the day, everybody wants transparency to make sure that the vote is counted accurately and that there are no mishaps or mistakes.
Right. And just the few seconds we have, the president's campaign advisor, Jason Miller, claimed today it will be clear as soon as tomorrow that the president has won. And, you know, they feel that he is winning.
Sure. But that's a lot of public relations. At this point, I wouldn't put a lot of stock in that kind of bluster at this point. I would continue to listen to the local elections officials. And everybody needs to remember that nothing is official until these states certify their results.
Yeah. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson says the Trump campaign lawsuit challenging her state's preliminary election results is, quote, frivolous. The Associated Press has called Michigan for Joe Biden, who is leading there by nearly 3 percentage points or about 150,000 votes. Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson joins us now with the latest on the effort there. She's a Democrat. Secretary, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to get to the vote count, but first, let's talk a little bit about this lawsuit. The Trump campaign is arguing that campaign observers have been denied adequate access to vote tallying locations, and they're calling for Michigan to stop counting ballots. How do you respond to that?
Sure. A number of things. First, we have consistently followed all the protocols and really ensured transparency throughout our process, both through the voting process and the tabulation process. We've been very meticulous, secure, transparent. Notably, the process went very, very smooth. We had observers involved on both sides and many organizations throughout the day on Tuesday and Wednesday, all throughout the state. And it really wasn't until, you know, we got towards the end that we started to see people coming in who had not been involved in the process up to that point. You know, you saw what happened at TCF and really seemed like trying to interfere with the process. We're not going to let any campaign or candidate or political party stop our work to ensure that every vote is counted and every voice is heard.
Well, let me ask you about what happened yesterday at the TCF Center, as you mentioned. That's where police officers barred Republican and Democratic poll challengers from entering the room where ballots were being counted inside of the convention center. I mean, this event shows just how contentious this entire process has become. What did this incident reveal to you as someone who's really tasked with keeping polling centers safe and clear for workers to do their jobs?
That we have to continue to stay steadfastly focused on that. We're in this very unique moment in the history of our country. We've seen throughout this entire election cycle, anxiety and tensions are very high right now. And we have tried in Michigan, really in a bipartisan way, with clerks on both sides of the aisle and election workers also on both sides of the aisle, to make sure that we focus on simply ensuring every vote can be counted, every vote is validated, no invalid votes are counted, all of those things. And it really wasn't until where, you know, results began to be talked about in a more concrete way that we started to see some of the disruptions. Despite all of the national rhetoric and attempts to undermine folks' perceptions about the integrity of our process, it actually exceeded our expectations, both in efficiency and in integrity and in security. That, to me, at the end of the day, is the story. Here in Michigan, we saw more people vote than ever before, and we saw more people come together from both sides to really protect the process. And moving forward, I think we're just going to see more evidence of why that's truly the case here in our state.
Well, we know that Michigan was one of the states to receive federal funding for election security improvements, receiving over $12 million. How was that money used, and was it a significant help?
That enabled us to effectively ensure voters knew how to vote from home and how to vote absentee and how to deliver in cases where the mail service was unreliable, how to make sure their ballots got in on time. So we were able to fund and install drop boxes all across the state of Michigan and secure them as well with surveillance footage. We increased the number of high-speed ballot tabulators, which did increase the efficiency of our tabulation process over the past 48 hours. So all of that was really critical, and I'm hopeful in the future we'll continue to see more of that support come forward from our federal government.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the vote count. In a news conference late last night, you said the process of the tabulation for the state is complete, and counties were in their final stages of receiving reports from remaining jurisdictions. What's the latest on that effort, and has every vote been counted?
Yes, the tabulation was complete as of last night. What happens at that point is then they essentially, at the local level in the city and townships throughout the state, dot every I, cross every T, and then formally report out the results to the county. Now, we have 83 counties, and then that gets reported up to the state. So we're now today in the process of getting those reports out from counties. And then at that stage in the process, we have this certification and canvassing period. That's going to happen over the next 10 days when we again review all the processes at the state, county, and local level to ensure all protocols were followed. Every vote was counted and validated before we get into the final certification in the next 10 days or so.
So over the next 10 days, you'll be going through the certification process. What are your primary concerns over the next few days?
I think, you know, especially as we see, you know, other disruptions occurring in other states where counts are still ongoing, that we can really come together and recognize that the patriotic thing to do at this moment in time is to respect the integrity of our elections, respect the will of the people, and ensure and have faith that every valid vote will count and that every voice will be heard.
That's Jocelyn Benson, Michigan Secretary of State. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We may soon know who's the next president of the United States, but then comes the hard part. Today we want to start a conversation about how to go forward after an election that revealed the country cleaved over cultural and political issues, including a pandemic, a racial reckoning, and the very definition of truth. Bakari Sellers, political commentator and former Democratic South Carolina state rep, is here. And Bakari, you know, we're hearing leading Democrats across the country are stunned. They thought they'd flip the Senate, win state legislatures, reverse Republican redistricting. Record numbers of dollars were spent. We want to know what you think happened and how to go forward, but how would you characterize where Democrats are?
A good day. I don't think that, you know, there are too many sad faces anytime you can take back the White House and you still have the ability to win the United States Senate with two races in Georgia. And if anybody would have told me before the election that we would flip Arizona and potentially Georgia, then I would have been over the moon. We didn't get all the victories we wanted. And this country, it showed who it truly is by expanding Donald Trump's base and people still coming out and voting for that racism and bigotry. It wasn't an outright rejection of it, but this is a victory, and you run races to win them. And when Joe Biden becomes the next president of the United States, you cannot say that's a bad day.
Well, but Bakari, I'm talking about going forward. And by the way, Joe Biden has not yet reached that magic number of 270, and President Trump still has a path to victory. We want to make sure we note that. But, you know, when Republicans lost so handily years ago, there was a postmortem, and the conclusion was they had made a terrible mistake. They had to reach out to Hispanics. They, you know, had to reach out more to women. They you know, told themselves they had to do these things that they did not do, actually. Some would say, you know, maybe they paid for it in some ways. What do Democrats have to do to begin healing this country? We can't go forward with this division. We'll kill ourselves just with a COVID-19 alone if we, you know, don't have more Americans believing that it even exists. How does that happen?
Well, I mean, I think that you're going to have a president finally who takes it seriously, who listens to scientists. On COVID, there are two tracks that you have to run. One is an economic one to rebuild an economy that's been devastated by the virus, and also a public health one that we have to make sure that we're doing everything necessary and we get a vaccine that is safe and effective. And so I believe those things will happen. I don't know exactly what people should expect going forward, because we saw, 55% of white women coming out and still supporting Donald Trump. We saw the reason that we're in the position we are now with Joe Biden being on the verge of being a president-elect is because of black voters in Atlanta, black voters in Milwaukee, black voters in Philadelphia, black voters in Detroit. And so as the country and the demographics of the country continue to evolve and continue to change, we still have fundamental issues that we just have never dealt with. Fundamental issues of race, fundamental issues of income inequality. We just have structural issues that no one has addressed. And it's going to be really difficult for Joe Biden to do that with Mitch McConnell being the leader. But at least we will begin to do that and recognize how we got to this point.
Yeah, but in order, we are told by every conflict resolution expert that in order to move forward, there has to be some empathy for people on the other side of the divide. You know, what do you think, where can you find that for? And I'm not talking about the militias who, you know, think that Donald Trump represents them. I'm talking about the people, you know, the millions and millions and millions of people who made this such a tight race. Where can Democrats start there? We're told that many feel that, you know, they're ignored by people on the coasts, that, you know, their jobs are ignored, their, what they value is ignored. Where does that get bridged?
I mean, I think you saw Vice President Biden run a race attempting to bridge that. But this is, I mean, this is a difficult question because, you know, I don't necessarily look at it through the same lens that you do. I look at it as there are many voters in this country, particularly black voters in this country, who just saved the democracy. And now you want us to do what? What else do you want us to do? So my point to you is that we're going to govern. Joe Biden is going to be, and Kamala Harris will be, president of the United States. They will not be president of Democrats or of blue states. Mm-hmm. And for the last 4 years, we've had division. We've had hatred coming from on high, coming from the highest levels of government. That will change. That will help us heal. But I'm not sure what else you want us to do.
Right. Well, and you're speaking as a black American, one whose father was injured in the civil rights movement. And I hear you. I was going to ask also that while people are saying we have to reach out to the Trump people, Americans have to reach out to Trump supporters, I can hear you saying, as an African American, wait, we get in the back of the line again. That sounds like what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. I just think that, you know, for me, I just think that you pass an agenda that's healthy for this country. You continue to grow, expand and go from there.
Thank you, Bakari Sellers, author and commentator.
Okay, let's get an update now from Georgia, where election officials are reporting more vote tallies. The latest numbers show that President Trump's lead among votes counted so far falling to below 14,000. The state's voting system implementation manager, Gabriel Sterling, said this morning that he is prayerful that all votes will be counted by the end of today. Joining us now is Emil Moffitt, reporter at WABE in Atlanta. And Emil, how many votes are still left to be counted, and how much has counting mail-in ballots helped close this gap for Biden?
Yeah, Tanya, we just got an update from the Secretary of State's office. 47,000 ballots, absentee ballots, left to count as of this hour in Georgia. So they're getting at it. It's taken a while, but it's happening. And what we've seen over the course of the last 24 to 36 hours is that all of these ballots that are still being counted are mail-in ballots, and those have favored the Democrat Joe Biden. So we have seen Donald Trump's lead in Georgia dropped dramatically in the last 36 hours. As you mentioned, it's down to the last update, 13,220, the difference between the two candidates.
Mm. What are the counties that you're specifically watching?
We are watching Fulton, obviously, is the largest county in Georgia. It does lean Democrat very heavily in Fulton County. They have completed the counting in Fulton County, but they're still uploading those results to the Secretary of State's website, so they haven't necessarily all shown up. There's about 5,000 left to show up on Fulton's side, so that could even cut into the lead, the president's lead, a little bit more. We're also watching Chatham County, Savannah, which is also a Democrat-leading area. There are still 17,000 absentee ballots to be processed and scanned and counted and uploaded there. So that could be another area in which Joe Biden picks up some more votes.
Remind us briefly why Georgia is so critical to this presidential race right now.
It's critical not only because it's close, but because this is a place where Donald Trump won by 5 points 4 years ago. And now with a million new registered voters in the course of the last couple of years, it is become a toss-up state, And, you know, some of the president's advisors are saying that, you know, if they don't win Georgia, that could be the ball game for everything. And so I think, you know, a win here for Joe Biden would pretty much seal the deal. And it would just be an incredible turnaround story in politics coming from 2016 to now.
Let's talk a little bit about litigation. A Georgia judge has thrown out this lawsuit from the Trump campaign that tried to invalidate some of these mail-in ballots, alleging that they came in after 7 p.m. on election night. Are we likely to see another challenge in the state? And if so, on what grounds?
I would imagine we may see some more legal action based on the extreme close nature of this race. But quite frankly, it's going to have to be on process more than the laws themselves. This is a state with a Republican Secretary of State, a Republican-controlled state election board, and a Republican legislature. So as far as the laws go, there's not really a lot for Republicans to complain about. They're going to have to go after, as was mentioned in this lawsuit, which was dismissed this morning, the process of actually handling the ballots and what the process is going as far as handling those ballots that were received before and after 7 o'clock on election night, which is kind of the deadline and the line of demarcation for what ballots are going to be counted and what are not.
Georgia law allows for a recount at fewer than 0.5% difference. Is the Biden camp preparing for a legal fight, too?
I think that, you know, they definitely could be. You know, this race could come down to just a couple of thousand votes, well within the margin. So I think no matter what happens in this state, no matter who comes out on top when all the votes are counted here in the next day or two, I think we could see a recount definitely is something that both parties would like to challenge. Depends on who comes out on top.
30 seconds I have with you. What's the latest on the Senate race there between Republican David Perdue and Democrat John Ossoff?
It is looking more and more like a second Senate race in Georgia will go to a runoff in January. David Perdue has just dropped below the 50% mark, which you're required to attain here in Georgia to win an election. And so John Ossoff, the challenger, is hoping to get into that runoff in January, which could very well determine the control of the U.S. Senate with two races here in Georgia.
That's Emil Moffitt, reporter at WABE in Atlanta. As always, thank you. Pro-Trump protesters gathered in Phoenix last night, calling for all votes to be counted as we await the results of the presidential election. Democratic candidate Joe Biden is maintaining the lead in Arizona, and the AP has already called the key state for Biden. Let's bring in Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix for more on this. And Peter, what's the latest there in Arizona?
Yeah, Tanya, so it's important to note, last night, two new batches of votes from Maricopa County came in. We've said this before. We said this yesterday. Maricopa County is the key to Arizona. There's last night, that new tally, about 62,000 ballots came in, and those went to President Trump by a ratio of about 58% to 41%. So Biden's lead statewide dropped down to 68,000 votes. Now, this next part is very important. Trump has to continue to gain at that rate as the rest of the votes come in if he wants to overtake Biden, and that could still be tough for the president.
Okay, so do we know where the outstanding votes are left still to be counted?
We do have a pretty good idea. About 86% of the vote is in for Arizona. Many of the votes that are outstanding are in places where Democrats actually do pretty well. There's Pima County. That's where Tucson is. They have about 55,000 votes left to count. Now, most of the outstanding ballots are in Maricopa County. 275,000 votes are left. And something important to remember here is that Phoenix is not the blue city that many others are. It's not Las Vegas, where there's a hot count going on right now. This is not Philadelphia, another place that's in contention. This is not Atlanta, still very conservative part of the state in the suburbs around central Phoenix. And it's only recently been turning blue. So that is what we need to watch.
Okay. How are folks on the ground in both camps, I mean, basically handling this pressure as the votes continue to be tallied?
Yeah, so I was on the phone today with Lucha. It's a group that's responsible for mobilizing young Latino Democrats to the polls. They are watching this closely, just like everybody else in the state, but they also tell me they're optimistic, that they trust their voters and they're trusting the process. The Biden campaign even came out today and said they're still confident in Arizona, although they do say it may take more time to see the full result in the state, and they acknowledge that the race may likely tighten. You heard the chance of Republicans there at the top. They're saying count the votes, and that is essentially where Republicans are today. I spoke with one who wasn't feeling great yesterday, but now who is holding on to just a little sliver of hope here. And he pointed to the 6th congressional district in the state, which is where I am in North Phoenix. The incumbent Republican, David Schweikert, was losing to the Democrat on election night. But now, as these new votes have come in, he's up by 6,000 votes. So, yes, oh, wow. AP has called the race for Arizona. Other networks have not. Trump could come back, but it will take a lot of work. A lot of work. And Republicans also say the closer it gets, the more likely it is that a bunch of lawyers are going to start coming to town.
Sure. With the 30 seconds I have for you, remind us again what's next, when we can expect the next round of votes to come in.
Sure. Key County, Maricopa County, 7 o'clock tonight, local time. There'll be another vote dump. It's possible we get a big chunk of those outstanding 275,000 remaining votes. And then Pima County, where Tucson is, the very blue area of the state, we expect to get about 22,000 of those later this afternoon or earlier this evening.
Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix, Arizona. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Tanya.
We want a quick touchdown now in Nevada, where new numbers released today by the Secretary of State's office show Joe Biden has increased his lead with about 12,000 more votes than President Trump. Just 30 minutes before those numbers were released, the Trump campaign announced they're filing a federal lawsuit alleging voter fraud, saying thousands of illegal votes by non-residents are being counted. Let's bring in politics reporter Paul Bozier from KUNR in Reno, Nevada. Paul, we're not trusting the technology right now. We're going to have you on your phone. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
And as we know, Nevada is a crucial state for both candidates, but particularly Biden, because the AP has him at 264 electoral votes, including Arizona. Nevada has 6 electoral votes. That would put Biden at 270, the magic number where someone is the next president. So which counties are counting ballots? When can we expect more results? What's going on?
Well, I'll tell you, all counties are still counting ballots. I will tell you that we're going to see the most change in either Clark or Washoe counties. Those are the two populated counties in the state. And what we got today, we got new numbers at 9 a.m. here, local time, from the Secretary of State's office. And we're starting to see the smaller counties, or the Washoe and the Clark, release those individual numbers. And while we have seen kind of a slight change in Biden's favor, he extended that lead. It's not like we're getting a whole bunch of a really conclusive data. It looks like it's still that razor-thin results. And here in Washoe County in particular, this is the swing county in Nevada. It remains a 10,000-vote split. Even though we got new numbers, it's 10,000 votes that separate Biden and Trump here in Washoe County.
Yeah. And as we mentioned, the Trump campaign is challenging that count, and it's not the first lawsuit filed by the Trump campaign. And the state doesn't have an automatic recount. So just briefly, right, what is this path there for Republicans?
So to talk about the recount, Nevada doesn't have an automatic one. However, a candidate can request a recount at any time. They just have to pay for it. So we'll see if that happens in the coming days. As for the lawsuit, so they filed the lawsuit in federal court, and what they're saying is that they've had reports over the last few days of what they call issues or they have concern. They're saying that dead people have voted, that people who moved out of Clark County specifically, they mentioned, cast mail-in ballots as they were leaving. So they're saying they want a judge, a federal judge, to stop the count immediately.
Okay. A lot to follow as we watch Nevada closely today. We'll probably be in touch with you again over the next couple of days, but just briefly in the few seconds we have, what's the mood there?
Everybody is waiting very patiently, at least where I am. We did have some small protests in Washoe County last night. There was a larger one in Las Vegas last night, the Stop the Count rally. But again, we're not really seeing any unrest. However, police say they are ready for it. They're blocking off portions of downtown in Reno, so we're waiting.
Yep, and nerves on edge. KUNR politics reporter Paul Bozier in Reno, Nevada. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, as we continue to digest the incoming results of this election, we wanted to take a look at some of the early exit polls, which tell us who voted and for whom. Let's bring in Eugene Scott. He covers identity politics for The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. And we want to reiterate that these exit polls will, of course, be adjusted over time as more of the votes come in. But outlets like The Washington Post and CNN, The New York Times are publishing them with this caveat. So I want to take a look at them. What stood out to you the most about who voted this year and for whom?
Well, I think one of the main focuses will be on how Latino voters voted this year. As you noted, these exit polls are preliminary and subject to change, but I think that is an area that will receive a lot of attention regardless of how new information changes the outcome. And particularly, I think it will reveal to many Americans something that we should have known, but we appear not to, which is that the Latino community is large and diverse and perhaps cannot be summed up in very, you know, unsophisticated, generalized ways that we too often talk about communities of color.
Can you break that down a little more? Are you talking about the differences in populations? For instance, in Arizona, a huge Mexican-American population, and in Florida, a huge Cuban and Venezuelan population.
Absolutely. So Arizona's Latino population, as you noted, is predominantly Mexican-American. It's also largely female. There are a sizable percentage of young voters in Arizona that are really shaping things. And its location on the border is definitely a determining factor in how it engages politics and particularly the immigration issue. South Florida in particular has a large Cuban and Venezuelan and Colombian and Nicaraguan population, as you mentioned. And all of these immigrants come from countries that were socialist at one point. And perhaps part of the reason why these individuals immigrated to the U.S. Large percentages of these Latino communities self-identify as white and therefore vote like white people. Many of them are evangelical Christians or Catholics and therefore vote like conservative evangelicals and conservative Catholics. They are largely older than many of the Latino voters that we see somewhere like Arizona or even Texas. And so these differences certainly help determine different outcomes. Also wanted to note that, as we know, Florida is a long state. If you move further north, you have other Latino communities like the Puerto Rican community and the Dominican communities that vote differently from Latino communities in South Florida. And so I think what I would love for us to see is a diversity in the media and how we cover Latino communities to help Americans better understand the country in which we live.
I'm looking at data from Edison Research, which supplies this data to many media outlets. Out of more than 15,000 people polled, we're seeing 72% of non-white voters backed Biden, while 57% of white voters backed Trump. What does this say about us that so much of the post-election analysis seems fixated on Trump's relatively small gains with voters of color?
I think it's really important for us to recognize that whatever gains he made overall were because white voters stuck with him and were able to get behind him in maybe some ways a little higher than they did in 2016. You know, there will be some on the right, particularly, who will try to make the case that any victory he's experiencing is due to gains with voters of color. But none of those gains were significant enough to lead to a win. It has been the president's ability to connect with the worldview and the ideology of white voters and actually turn them out at the rate that he needs to remain competitive.
I want to ask you about something else, and that's the concept we have in our heads of who a Trump supporter is. According to exit polls done by Edison Research for the New York Times, lower-income voters supported Biden, middle-income voters supported Biden, and those making over $200,000 a year supported Biden. But in fact, according to this early exit poll, the only income bracket supporting Trump was households making between $100,000 and $200,000 a year. This is really interesting. Your thoughts on this?
We had some surveying come out from PRRI, I think that's Public Religion Research Institute, talk about the economic anxieties of Trump supporters. And I think many people assumed that that anxiety was coming from people from working class households. But the data actually supported that it was actually coming from people who were doing relatively well compared to the average American. But they were still really anxious about how America's changing demographics could affect their well-being. And so this seems to reinforce the idea that it's not working class or even poor people who got behind the Trump campaign overwhelmingly, but people who were doing quite fine, but were really nervous about their status changing. Hmm.
Eugene Scott covers identity politics for The Washington Post and hosts a new podcast coming out tomorrow called The Next 4 Years. Eugene, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Remember the good old days when we would turn to sports to take a break from the news? You didn't even have to watch it, just have it on. Well, those days are gone, thanks to the pandemic. No games for months, and even when they started up again, they were played in bubbles without fans. There's been some easing, but despite the U.S. continuing to set records for daily numbers of coronavirus infections, you know, there can't be too many. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, it's November. Homecoming? No. You know, this is usually the heart of the college football season. So what's the latest there?
Yeah, well, the heart is experiencing maybe a little cardiac arrest because every week different teams are unable to play because of outbreaks. This week, Louisville is added to the list. Wisconsin once again has to cancel games. They just have so many players with COVID. But probably the biggest story is that Trevor Lawrence, the Clemson quarterback, who was the favorite to win the Heisman Trophy and just a tremendous quarterback. You know, the NFL's looking at him as the next great quarterback in their league. He tested positive. So he has since had a couple of negative tests, but he did not play against Boston College. He will not be playing against Notre Dame. He is no longer the Heisman favorite. I mean, it's no tragedy. He's going to get well. Right. Clemson staged an amazing comeback win, but it's definitely having a huge impact on the season.
And we know that it is no tragedy, and the fact that he got tested is fantastic, and that takes him, you know, he's not going to be infecting other people, and COVID-19 is still, you know, the biggest deal around. We know that. We're just talking sports, but you know, college basketball's March Madness was one of the first major events canceled by the pandemic this year. I was going to say there goes all that office fun, except so few people are in their offices. But is there going to be men's and women's college basketball this season?
There is, in just a couple weeks. And in fact, teams are practicing. At first, the season was going to start November 10th, but they did push that back a couple of weeks. But the season will start just a couple weeks past when it usually starts. And the madness is still scheduled for March. So that is one thing that is going, or two things, men and women's, that are going ahead as planned.
Okay. Let's see. We just had the election. Athletes and leagues were so involved in the get out the vote effort and in, you know, getting their own voices out. What'd you see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the NBA had a plan to allow arenas to be voting sites. And in fact, that plan went into place. And, you know, the where the Hawks play in Fulton County was the biggest election center in the history of the state. And in fact, they're still doing some of the vote count in State Farm Arena. If you were following the news, there was a delay of 4 hours because a pipe burst there. But they voted where the at the Toyota Center in Houston, and they voted or they used as a polling place the Henry Ford Performance Center in Detroit. So a lot of NBA arenas were used. I wasn't going to say I was skeptical of the use. I was just wondering, well, I wonder how big an impact it will have. You know, according to election officials, it did alleviate voting pressure. Of course, early voting did too. But some of these sites, many of these sites were used as an early voting place. So that really did have an impact. And just lately, vote counters in Pennsylvania were fed by members of the Pittsburgh Steelers who bought them dinner. So in many ways, professional sports teams are having an effect on the vote.
Yeah. I want to ask about pro hockey and basketball. They've been played in bubbles, you know, as we said, in the shortened seasons this year. Is there a plan for those sports, you know, the pro next season?
Yes, but it's not set in stone. And there was talk of resuming play maybe in December. But Adam Silver, commissioner of the NBA, is now saying, no, let's look to 2021 to start the season. You know, I've seen proposals and it seems plausible, but I don't know, or it seems possible, I don't know how plausible, that you might have a staggered start. Because remember, we just mentioned the Atlanta Hawks. They were a team that didn't even qualify or get invited to the bubble. So those players haven't played since March. They are fresh. They are fresher or maybe even rustier than an NBA team has ever been. But if you look at the LA Lakers and the Miami Heat, they just got done playing a month ago. So they might need a little more rest. So what if you start play, draw the season out a little more and start play with teams that, you know, haven't been playing in recent months? I don't know that the NBA is considering it, but given their flexibility so far, you know, maybe they should.
I just want to mention something about hockey because it's on my mind right now, which is that here in Massachusetts, where this part of the program is based, you know, our governor says that it was hockey leagues that were part of the big spike in coronavirus that we just had recently in COVID-19. It was, you know, people playing hockey indoors. So I just, you know, that's on my mind as well. Quick, in the minute we have, baseball. According to the New York Post, MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred says teams lost about $3 billion collectively during shortened season. You know, this must be raising a lot of questions about that sport's future.
Yes, but I would caution that the revenue did have an impact, as almost all revenue did, but the value of the franchise is the resale value, and there are still only 30 of them, and billionaires still want to buy in. So cries of poverty, I wouldn't totally dismiss them, but most of these owners are doing just fine.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.